Our study today is Battle with the Beast. Today is April the 5th of 2013, and I'm happy to come before you this Friday the 7th evening. Let us begin by thinking and pondering. We know, as we saw 2 weeks ago from Revelation chapter 12, that the dragon is at war with the woman. We know that the dragon is representative of the devil. Now we're launching forward into Revelation chapter 13 and chapter 14, and it mentions a lot about the dragon. And the question, as the light is unfolded, as we venture forward in this day of marvel, is why is the devil going to have some degree of success as he fights for souls? We're told that multitudes are going to reject the kingdom appeal. And it may seem difficult, a reference that I've committed to memory, found in Isaiah 29, verses 13 and 14, it says, "Wherefore saith the Lord, for as much as this people draw near me with their mouth and do honor me with their lips, but their hearts are removed far from me, wherefore behold, I shall proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, for the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid." Go back and check the reference is correct if you need to have it precisely stated to you. But I marry that with our theme today because we've learned that David, in the house of David, the disciples indeed, will manifest great power. Power to heal, power to raise the dead, power over the armies of the world. But we must ask ourselves, why? When? How? Who will succumb to Satan's sophistry? When the light of heaven begins to shine brighter, how will billions end up rejecting the Lord's salvation? I don't know about you, but I've pondered upon that question. As we advance, let us turn to Psalms chapter 48. In fact, let us label Psalms 48 as our preliminary text. As we read, we may diverge here a little and there a little, but we're going to read Psalms 48 verses 1 and 2, and then we're going to go down to verses 8 through 14. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God. In the mountain of his holiness. I know you've heard this as a cantata, but now it's time to unlock its meaning. That means we have to peer more deeply into it than we have been inspired to do in the past. We know, first of all, that when David refers to the Lord, we're told in Matthew 22 and in other places, he's referring to Christ. He's not referring to God the Father. In fact, we see in John chapter 17, he expressed in prayer to the Father his desire to receive his glory again because he had revealed the name of the Father. In other words, they didn't know the Father's identity in the Old Testament. It was only through Jesus' testimony that it was unraveled to us. That there was one that was greater than the person whom David called Lord. And now David is saying, great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised. He didn't just leave it there. He gave some meaning to that expression. He said, in the city of our God, you may not have had the respect for the Lord that you needed to have. You really didn't know his identity. You know, the scripture of emphasis, you find it in Matthew 11, you find it in Luke 10, the Lord says, no man knoweth whom the Father is but the Son, and whom the Son is but the Father, and he to whom the Son will reveal. In Matthew chapter 11, he continues on after that theme. He says, learn of me. And consequently, the day is going to come, based upon this text, when the Christ is going to receive praise. Praise, as you'll see from reading the Psalms 48, in the city of our God. But not just in the city. Cities can be big. I need more detail, David. I need more detail because I'm concerned about what you said. I know that according to Luke 24:44, that the Lord promised to fulfill all those prophecies that were written of him in Psalms. Therefore, the Lord, meaning Christ, I need to know where you're going to find him and where is it that he's going to be receiving this great praise. Now, as we read, let's continue on and we perhaps can uncover the location. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of his holiness. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. Now we found out not just that in the day of the Lord he's going to receive praise in the whole earth, but now we know where his location is going to be. It's going to be in Mount Zion. Well, we can reverse the question. Where's Mount Zion? It's not in the city of the Lord. It's in the city of the great king. Jerusalem is the capital city of the world. It's going to be. And that's going to be the location of the great king. We're going to see, as we read this text, that the Bible defines the city of the great king in Psalms. It defines a plurality of kings. It speaks of the Lord. But we need to understand and define whom the great king represents. It's not enough for you to say that it represents this office, the mustard seed. Derek West. Some people would say that's immodest. But when the Lord makes a promise, it needs to be echoed. We're still in the preliminary text. I don't want you to lose your place there. But let's talk a little bit more about the great king. Let's read another text that the Lord promised to fulfill. Let's turn to Psalms 110, verse 1 and 2. The Lord said unto my Lord, if Christ, talking to somebody whom David referred to as my Lord. Therefore, if you're careful at counting, some of you have got the skill, you can count from 1 to 3 at least. You see 3 personalities. You see the Lord that we know is Christ. Matthew 22, David calleth him Lord, from whence then is he his son? He's having a conversation with David's Lord. Therefore, you have the Lord, which is Christ. You have David, and you have David's eternal son, whom we're told is going to rule over all generations. Therefore, he becomes David's Lord. The Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. And consequently, he sits at the right hand of Christ. Christ is taking actions, many of which you cannot even discern, but he's working it so that he could make David's enemies his footstool. Then it says, verse 2 of Psalms 110, as we work our way back to our preliminary text of Psalms 48, it says in verse 2, the Lord shall send the rod of thy strength out of Zion, rule thou in the midst of thine enemies. Now you have Christ receiving praise, and then he's transferring it to a separate individual. And he's commanded that individual to rule. That individual could be nothing other than the great king. Else Christ would say, sit down on my right hand and let me rule. Watch me rule amongst your enemies. He transfers power. This is the glory that he petitioned the Father to reserve for the disciples. Rule thou in the midst of thine enemies. But he leaves Zion for that commission. Zion is prefigurative of the Lord's eternal church, which is going to be literally relocated in Jerusalem, the Mount of Zion. Jerusalem. Now, how do you know it's Jerusalem? We don't need to leave that to conjecture. Let us turn from Psalms 110 to 1 Kings chapter 11. Some of you have thought incorrectly on this subject. I'll make a brief comment as you're finding your way to that text. You presumed that this rulership would be done by Christ hidden and working through David. Christ hides and speaks through David, but you have to understand, this authority is conveyed upon the Son of David. Well, that's not fair. That's not right. But it's got to be fair and it's got to be right. This is what saves the world. Look at it simplistically. All these years, you've opened up the Bible and you've ignored the simple statements therein. You couldn't accept Christ's judgment and his rulership in your life. You couldn't keep the Sabbath. You couldn't refrain from worshiping idols. You couldn't refrain from dishonoring your parents. You couldn't refrain from eating unclean meats. Yet you had the audacity to say you prefer Christ to rule over you. You prefer Christ to rule over you because you have become acclimated in sidestepping Christ. Seventh Day Adventist Church is an event. They've ignored the testimony of Jesus. I'm tired of arguing with Adventists about the fact that they're going to receive, based upon the Lord's promise, life without death. Life without the grave. One of the plainest statements in the Bible. How dare you pretend like you prefer Christ's leadership? He's got a plan to save, let's not talk about Laodicea now, but to save the people of the world. They have objected to his rulership. Therefore, he causes you to be governed by one, by the caprice of one whom he selected, a man after his own heart. David, son of David, mustard seed, Derek West, I think that you were rash in your judgment. But you thought the same thing about Christ. What difference does it make? And the reason why you think it's capricious and rash is because you don't believe that God is with us. But I mentioned 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 35 and 36. It says, but I will take the kingdom out of his son's hand and will give it unto thee, speaking to somebody else, a man by the name of Jeroboam, even 10 tribes. There were 12 tribes that David and Solomon and Rehoboam ruled over, but Solomon lost the 10 tribes, and they fell under Rehoboam's reign to a man named Jeroboam. 10 of them fell. And unto his sons will I give one tribe, that David, my servant, David is dead and gone. But the Lord promised to reserve one tribe, that David, my servant, may have a light always before me in Jerusalem. the city which I have chosen me to put my name there. When we hear in our preliminary text, Psalms 48, the city of the great king, it's talking about the light that the Lord has reserved for David's lineage. The city where he promised to eternally govern from. It's important to really understand and underscore these geographic locations. I like what Matthew chapter 5 adds to this conversation. Verse 33. Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oath. But I say unto you, verse 34, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne. He could have said, heaven is my throne. This is Christ speaking. He's showing you a distinction between himself and the Father, the highest. One that we've taken great care to explain in prior studies. Don't swear by heaven, because why? It's God's throne. Nor by the earth, for it is his footstool. Neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. You don't have the authority to denigrate or to swear by heaven or by earth or by Jerusalem. You have to have respect for the Father and somebody else, the great king. Let's wrestle with this a little bit more and turn to Matthew chapter 19, verse 28. Verily, verily, I say unto you, that ye which have followed me in the regeneration, when the Son of Man shall sit in the throne of his glory. Now we have deeper insight. It's referring to the Son of David. It says the Son of Man because he's obeisant to the man. That makes him the Son. The man being the Father. This is why Jesus is the Son of Man, why Christ is the Son of Man, this is why David is the Son of Man. They all seek to do the will of the Father, as any obedient son should do. Getting back to the text, Matthew chapter 19, verse 28. Verily I say unto you, that ye which have followed me in the regeneration, when the Son of Man shall sit in the throne of his glory, ye shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Shows you a collection of disciples, 12 of them. They don't sit on the Son of Man's throne. They have their own thrones. This is going to occur when the Son of Man is seated on his throne. We saw in Psalms 110, verses 1 and 2, that throne is located in Jerusalem. The Lord sends him forth with a rod in his hand and commands him to rule amidst his enemies. That text, by the way, suggests to you that there is a period of time whereby David rules and he has enemies that are fighting his rule. That's what makes them enemies. But the reason why we're putting so much emphasis on these locations is because yesterday, under partial inspiration, we presumed that Jerusalem was in heaven and that Mount Zion was in heaven. You cannot understand the mark of the beast unless you understand the geographical location of Zion. I told you we were going to work our way back to Psalms 48. And now we can read verses 8 through 14 and to finish off our preliminary text. As we have heard, I'm reading verse 8, so have we seen in the city of the Lord of hosts, in the city of our God. God will establish it forever. We have thought of thy loving kindness, O God, in the midst of thy temple. David is saying we haven't realized it fully yet. We've just meditated upon it. So he says, I've meditated upon the Lord day and night. He gave thought to it. He's looking forward to the day when it's going to be established. And that day, we are now looking forward to it as we rekindle these prophecies that the Lord promised to fulfill. We have thought of thy loving kindness. Verse 10. According to thy name, O God, so is thy praise unto the ends of the earth. Thy right hand is full of righteousness. He could have said, you're full of righteousness. But he's referring to the great king, the Lord's right-hand man. The world doesn't accede to his righteousness. They challenge his legitimacy. They decry against his wisdom and his judgment. That's why the world is his enemies. But David says that we look forward to his righteousness. Then he says, let Mount Zion rejoice. Mount Zion, now, is not only a geographical location, but it refers to a collection of people that are contained therein. I'm going to show you that this is making reference to 144,000, along with the disciples, along with Joshua, along with David. It's the center speck of righteousness on earth. Or we could go to Micah chapter 4. I'm trusting that you remember what that tells you about how the righteous are going to come to where? To Zion to learn the law. But first, before that happens, David says, let Mount Zion rejoice. Let the daughters of Judah be glad because of thy judgments. Walk about Zion and go round about her. He's talking to the people that are in existence in his day. Tell the towers thereof. In other words, we can begin this day of rejoicing now if you'll join with me. Interrupt your busy schedule. Traverse around Zion. Tell the leaders thereof, the towers thereof. Mark ye well her bulwarks. Why should they do this? It's an important point. Consider her palaces, that ye may tell it to the generation following. In other words, there's going to be a glorious day of resurrection. And these people are going to come forward. We're going to talk about that. They're going to come forward and they're going to describe to you, you're going to have fellowship with them, about how the city was located beforehand. So David is urging the people of his day that they need to prepare to tell it to generations following. How in the world can they tell the generations following? It could only be through resurrection. And since this event has not occurred yet, whereby Mount Zion, the city of the great king, has been established, then that generation can only be taught to be now here on the scene. That ye may tell it to generations following, for this God is our God forever and ever. And he will be our guide even unto death. As all we know, he's speaking to that generation of his day. Because he was going to be their God even unto death. What good is it to have a God unto death? Unless he's going to resurrect you. But I just want to say and reiterate that you cannot understand the mark of the beast until you find Zion, the Lord's geographic place of enlightenment for the earth. And speaking of the image of the beast, let's turn to verse 1 of Revelation 13. And I stood upon the sand of the sea. And I saw a great beast rise up out of the sea. He saw the great beast rise up out of the sea. That word is very important to our understanding. Psalms 89. I have sworn unto David, thy servant, thy seed will I establish forever, and build up thy throne to all generations. The enemy shall not exact upon him. The who? The enemy. This seed is going to be coexisted with the enemy and his empowerment. The enemy shall not exact upon him, nor the son of wickedness afflict him. And I will beat down his foes before his face. That means that the foes have got to be right there up in his face while the Lord beats them down. And plague them that hate him. Understand there's a conflict here. But my mercy will I keep with him. I will set his hand also in the sea, and his right hand in the rivers. He shall cry unto me, thou art my Father, my God, the rock of my salvation. Although David has enemies that rise up out of the sea, he has empowerment over them. For he's got the rod in his hand. Understand, we've already read that. We're going to speak to that some more. But I just want to emphasize that as we advance in Revelation chapter 13. A beast riseth out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. This beast has seven heads and ten horns. And upon his horns ten crowns. That means they're empowered kings, rulers, people of great magnitude and authority that existed, we'll see, yesterday. And upon their heads, the name blasphemy. That means they spoke blasphemous things against heaven. But heaven doesn't recriminate against them. It recriminates, as we shall see, against the governance that re-ingratiates this beast and restores his power, restores his vulgar blasphemies against heaven. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, and his seat, and great authority. If you read chapter 12, you'll see the dragon is the devil. He's the one that gave the Catholic Church of yesterday his authority and his power. Understand that although the dragon empowered him, it only happened because Father allowed him to emerge. And why the Father allowed him to emerge? Because it was during a time of ignorance. Jesus died to remove your sins of ignorance. That's by definition the sin offering. But when the light and truth comes, it's no longer a sin of ignorance. It's a premeditated sin. Therefore, there's a disparity with this blasphemy as the truth is unfolded, as the light of David shines forth from Zion. And I saw one of his heads wounded, as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. You have the period whereby the Catholic Church is in power, the period whereby she's disempowered, and the period that's promised to come where she is re-empowered. Oh, aren't you glad that the Lord gave David preeminence over his enemies and over the devil, the dragon? I swear him. And they worshiped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? And who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. Therefore, you need to understand from this text and from this reading that this power that's associated correctly to the emergence of the Catholic Church, part of its commission was ecclesiastical. He was given a mouth. That means that he was given the ability to communicate doctrine. And that doctrine was blasphemous. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwelt in heaven. We now have a clear picture of his blasphemies. He blasphemed God. Jesus died to cover our unknown sins. The Catholic Church for 1700 years taught that Jesus Christ was the same as the Father. Jesus Christ taught that the Father was greater. Therefore, they could not be the same. And by making Jesus and Christ the same as the Father, they denigrated the Father. What they needed to teach was the correct doctrine that Jesus Christ continuously honored the will of the Father. That's why he taught him to pray, "Our Father who art in heaven," not on earth, but in heaven, "hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done." It says he blasphemed those that dwelt in heaven. There's only one or two people that we know of in heaven. Therefore, there could not be much blasphemy to the others, other than Jesus and Christ. They claim that Jesus and Christ were the same, and they both were the same as the Father, that Jesus pre-existed his birth, contrary to the Bible's clear definition that he was conceived in the womb of Mary. Thus they give Jesus credit for creating the world, credit which Christ deserves. Understand, Jesus has no desire to take credit for what Christ has done. He applauds Christ. And Christ has no desire to take credit for the marvels that Jesus has performed these 2,000 years past with his administration over the Gentiles. But to make them one and the same is to diminish their work. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. This is something that has caused some people to tremble, but it's only because they don't know the empowerment of David. He's given power over his enemies. And think of it as a Super Bowl. You have two opposing teams, if you don't mind using a sports metaphor. And the team that's headed by David is going to win and gain victory. Therefore, if you know that in advance, you don't have any reason to be intimidated if you're on the right team. But we see from verse 7 that it was given unto him to make war with the saints. The only people that could be called saints are Christians. The only nation that has overcome and sought to vanquish the Christians was pagan and papal Rome. They made war against the saints and they overwhelmed them. That was yesterday. Today we see is a new day, a day of the Lord's power on earth. And this is why, if I can just refer you back to Psalms 48, it says, verse 1, "Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of his holiness." Until Christ is reestablished in Zion, located in Jerusalem, then if you're at war with that reestablishment, then you're at war with his victory over the devil and over the dragon. Because his establishment there is going to cause the world to erupt in a great praise. We're talking about the beast that emerged out of the sea. We've mentioned its historical perspective. Let us now read verses 11 through 18, and we can describe its reinstitution. This points to a day yet future, a day now that proper Davidians need no longer tremble, a day where Adventists, if they're enlightened, need not to be fearful of. Sure, the devil is going to have full reign over the earth on all parts except for Palestine. And the day is going to come when the great king is going to emerge with his rod and is going to punish and defeat the evil powers that the devil has established. How long will that take? Will it take a year? Will it take 10 years? Will it take 30 years? The Bible hasn't revealed. But you can rejoice now because you believe in the word of the Lord and the promise that he made that he would fulfill the promises of David. And we're going to see that he promised that David's team will win. I say that as a backdrop as we read verse 11 of Revelation chapter 13. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. This beast didn't come out of the sea. It came up out of the earth and had two horns like a lamb. And he spake as a dragon. He was a pretentious beast. He was Christ-like by pretense. But his doctrines were the doctrines of devils. He was charming. You'll see that he was able to seduce the nations by his duplicity. And he exercised all the power of the first beast before him. What's that power? That's a power to try to relinquish the saints and cause the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. That means that he is going to resist the gospel declared by the mustard seed, which is the gospel that declares the name of Christ. He's going to try to reinstall the blasphemies that the dragon proclaimed by the first beast. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire to come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceived them that dwelt on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, to say to them that dwell on earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. It's important, therefore, to understand what we learned. The entirety of the beast is captured by his blasphemies. And therefore, this beast that emerges out of the earth is attempting to reinstall those doctrines. Why does he feel the need to reinstall them? Because the gospel commission is pronouncing the doctrine that wins for people life everlasting. And the dragon wants to steal that away from the world. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. He doesn't give power to the beast. He doesn't give power to the Catholic Church. He gives power to the re-engeneration of the ethics and the persecutory demeanor of the first beast. He refers to that as the image of the beast. And he caused all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. You get to see now the challenge, because we're looking at a battle that's going to rage contemporaneously, whereby the 144,000 are going to go out from Zion and try to evangelize right under the nose of this great power, which we know to be America. It's going to use all of its might, all of its economic, military, and political might to foster the deceptions that were put forward by the Catholic Church so that the people will not trust in Christ. Therefore, the people will have a decision to make. They'll have a struggle, a moral struggle. You don't think it's a moral struggle? You presume that it will not be? Well, the Bible shows you here that it's going to be a difficult dilemma. We need to understand the mindset of the struggle. We need to get a picture of what dilemma and what mental struggle that the people will suffer under as they are seeking to refute the doctrines of the house of David as echoed throughout the world by a ministry of 144,000. So vehement and adamant will be the United States government. It controls the economies of the world that it's gone to place a premium on your loyalty by forbidding you from buying or selling unless you worship under the aegis that was established by the Catholic Church, the image that's rekindled, that no man might buy or sell, verse 17 of chapter 13, that no man might buy or sell save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. What's his name? What's his mark? Where can I go in the Bible to uncover that information? If you want to understand how to identify the mark of the beast, you have to garner that understanding from the light of Israel, from the son of David, from the mustard seed. That's why it says, here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast. For it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. We may not be able to pinpoint the identity of that man yet, because it could very well be that he's not on the scene. There are a multitude of other events that we're looking forward to unfold. But the day is going to come when understanding is going to emanate from Jerusalem by God's ministry. And it's going to show you the number of the beast, 666. Therefore, it may be useful for us to remind you all by this study how we can garner wisdom. Matthew chapter 7, verses 21 through 24. Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father, which is in heaven. You have to do the will of the Father to enter. You just can't talk Christ. You have to live Christ. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? And in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name have done many wonderful works. Then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man which built his house upon a rock. That's your only safety. By hearing the sayings of Christ and doing them, the one who leads you into that light is the one who establishes his house upon Christ, upon a rock. He is the wise man. He's the one that delivers wisdom. And it says in verse 25, and the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell not, for it was founded upon a rock. Another way to remind you that the house of David is impervious to the designs of the devil. It's guaranteed to gain victory from this struggle. And it does so, why? Because it does the will of the Father. Let's talk about the will of the Father in John chapter 6. Let's read verse 27. Labor not for the meat which perisheth, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you. We know this has to be referring to the great king, the rod-bearing servant that formerly was seated on the right hand of the Lord, his right hand of righteousness. Because the Lord says, labor not for the meat which perisheth, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you, not which I shall give unto you. For him hath God the Father sealed. If God the Father has sealed him, then he is eternally protected. There is no greater seal. You need to labor for his meat, the one whom the Father has ordained to proclaim his gospel. But where is it? Verse 39. We saw that the wise man does the will of the Father. And now we're going to read about that. And this is the Father's will which hath sent me, that of all which he hath given me, I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. So he refers to the words that he has spoken. Those who heed it are going to be made impervious to the storm. And the storm clouds, as we read, will be rising over the horizon, causing a lot of people to tremble. Continue with the will of the Father, reading John 6, verse 40 now. And this is the will of him that sent me, that everyone which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day. Three people are mentioned here: the Father, the Son, and the one who's speaking, which is Christ. The will of the Father is that everyone which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and that Christ will raise him up at the last day. You have the Father and Christ working together, understand. This is the day when the time of the Gentiles comes to an end, when Jesus transfers the reign to Christ. And therefore, the judgment of the Father is installed. Now, I know the Father judges no man. That's why he works carefully with Christ. He leads this Son of David, this light that's to blaze in the earth. He leads him to Christ so that he can declare the name of the Father and the Son. Hopefully we're not getting too complex here. But we need to understand that this person is sealed. And by that seal, we know that he gained victory over the devil and his forces. You want that seal. That allows us to transition into Revelation chapter 14. And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion. Now we have no confusion. We no longer need to debate where this Mount Zion is located. We saw that Mount Zion is going to be geographically located and headquartered in Jerusalem, under the Davidic kingdom, where Christ is seated and he empowers his right hand of righteousness to rule in the earth with his rod. That's why in Revelation chapter 14, verse 1, it says, and I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion. Now, understand, these events are happening contemporaneously. John the Revelator looked in one direction and saw the power of the dragon rekindled. Then he looked in the other direction and saw Christ on Mount Zion. He refers to him as the Lamb. There could be confusion on this issue. Let us not take too much time now. Let me refer you to some study information to show you that the Lamb makes reference to the Paschal Lamb. The Paschal Lamb, the Passover Lamb, was instituted in Exodus chapter 12 to eternally commemorate Israel's delivery from Egyptian slavery. And that's why you see the Lamb rekindled here, because he's redeeming his people eternally back to him. That Lamb stands on Mount Zion. We have John's witness according to Revelation chapter 14. And with them 144,000, having his Father's name written in their foreheads. And consequently, now that we know the geographic location of Mount Zion, We no longer have to construe it as the heavenly Mount Zion. It's not in the heavens. It's in the city of the great king. We can understand more about the 144,000. They are empowered when they reach that geographical location. That means, as prior studies have shown, that that's at the end of their training schedule. It could become confusing because Revelation chapter 7 defines the 144,000. Revelation chapter 7, verse 1 says, "And after these things I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth." Well, this is going to give you an understanding and an insight to the 144,000 you never heard or understood before. You may have had an inkling, but now in this context of our enlightenment, we can garner even a more powerful vision of their work. "After these things, I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the winds should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree." Remember, we were talking about the winds in Matthew chapter 7? How the one who trusts in the testimony of Jesus is protected and his house is going to stand when the winds blow? Well, now we have a deeper vision into that tempest. But Revelation chapter 7 delivers a very powerful point. The forces of hell cannot gain victory over heaven because the winds can't blow until heaven permits them to blow. That's why you have the four angels. You think that the angels stand and protect the mustard seed, and they do. But they have influence throughout the globe to ensure that the persecution doesn't occur until the 144,000 are sealed. That means they have to have the seal of the man that gives to them the bread that endureth unto everlasting life. The bread that we refer to in John chapter 6, verse 27. That's what you're to labor for. "And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God." See, "For him hath God the Father sealed." Remember that text? Therefore, he has it. This angel that ascends from the east begins his ride from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, his headquarters. And he has the seal. He has the ministry to install the gospel of Jesus into the foreheads of the saints so that they can garner understanding. "Having the seal of the living God, and he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, Hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads." This is the man with the seal. Yet we see in Revelation 14 that this theme of the 144,000 is revisited. I just want to address the distinctions between Revelation chapter 7, 144,000 mentioned therein, and Revelation chapter 14. Perhaps if we had time, we could visit Leviticus chapter 23, I believe it is, where it shows you the harvest. The 144,000, the ones that are going to be empowered to declare the gospel and that are eternally protected, that cannot die, the 144,000 are going to be garnered in, just as the wave sheaf offering during the Passover festivity manifests. Those grains of wave sheaf are going to be beaten and forged into bread. And when those bread loaves from the wave sheaf emerge, it says they are baked with leaven. They understand the doctrine of Christ. And you have therefore the wave sheaves and the wave loaves both representative of the 144,000. The wave sheaves as they are gathered in the harvest to receive the seal. The wave blows when they are refined Christians, fully baked and ready. Revelation chapter 14 gives us an insight to the 144,000 as they're fully baked. They're ready to go out and evangelize the earth because they have the doctrine of Christ. That's what we read last week. Let's revisit that in Revelation chapter 12. And the dragon was wroth with the woman, reading verse 17, and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus. Well, the reason why they're able to keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus is because the man of the seal harvested them and trained them and taught them. And that's why they're given victory and transport to be seated on Mount Zion with the Lamb. It continues in Revelation chapter 14 to describe the 144,000. Then in verse 4, it gives us a greater description. It says, describing the 144,000, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. The Bible usually doesn't speak of men as virgins. That reaches into what we understood from our prior study about spiritual fornication. These people, though they were in the worldly churches, did not devolve themselves into the worship of demons. They're not former people that escaped out of witchcraft, out of masonry, out of the other excesses that will cause a man to bow down and expose himself to false worship. And that's why they are virgins. The Bible understands something about virgins that we need to rekindle in our doctrine, in our theology. The Lord said that you can't put away your wife save for fornication. Which means that we've shown that fornication is not just adultery, but it points to other sexual excesses, which is merely a manner of a woman giving worship to a man. Whether your wife goes out and kisses a man on his lips passionately is in violation of what the Bible refers to as principles of intimacy, and you could put her away for fornication. Or whether she kisses other body parts to bring joy and pleasure to him, though she's not sexually penetrated, that's a form of fornication. It's false worship. But the important thing that we can understand from this text is that even before she's married, if her actions disturb you, so much so, because if a woman gives of herself in fornication, and then she doesn't divulge those things in her marriage, then it's bound to cause the husband to evoke jealousy. And therefore, the father gives allowance to put her away if you uncover her worshipful excesses sexually that she committed before she was married. And this is why the Lord places a limit of virginity on the 144,000. The 144,000 represents Jerusalem, the sons of America's former slaves, who are going to emerge from that antitypical Egyptian experience of enslavement. And those that have kept themselves pure from anything that would make the Lord jealous, they are given higher standard amongst that august body. They are made prophets, priests, and kings, rulers from Mount Zion, people ordained of God to declare the gospel. That's why, speaking of the 144,000, Revelation chapter 14, in reiteration, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. They follow Christ. How do they get to follow Christ? Because they learned of Christ. They were taught of Christ. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits, get this, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. This is not Jesus' administration. This is the administration of the Father. You remember how it says that God is not a God of the dead, but a God of the living? This is the day when the world is harvested and everlasting life is given to those who unite with his work. Jesus' administration covered the judgment of the dead, and those people will be called forward by the house of David in the resurrection, and they will be under the dominion, therefore, of the house of David. But God is going to gain rulership over those who have never seen death. That's why these are the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. We saw, as we read our preliminary text, Psalms 48, how they're going to declare the glory of the Lord from Mount Zion. This is the day, therefore, when Christ and Father are identified. Maybe we need to have a little more clarification about the virginity of the 144,000. Let's turn to 1 Kings. We see the importance of spiritual virginity even during the days of ancient Israel. Now, if you go to chapter 19 of 1 Kings, you'll be able to garner the dark spirituality of false worship. Elijah repined to Christ that he was the only one in Israel that didn't succumb to idolatry. And Christ responded in verse 18, "Yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which hath not kissed him." You didn't understand, therefore, that to become a Baal worshiper in Israel, you had to commit spiritual fornication. You had to bow down and kiss Baal's power. And that was something that Baal lauded throughout the heavens. He did that to blaspheme the name of Christ. His people bow down and kiss my power. Now imagine if you were married and your wife did that to another man, and that man went about the church and broadcast his excesses. That would be quite humiliating. This is why the Lord elects to have people to be his eternal rulers on the earth, and the subclass of the 144,000 that are defined as spiritual virgins. Therefore, we saw the two episodes of empowerment. We saw how the image of the beast is created and is given power by the beast that emerged out of the earth. More of that can be studied at a later date. But now we see the greater empowerment, the ones that receive the seal of God and are eternally protected from the enemy. And that's when the three angels' message comes into full fruition, beginning with the first angel, because the 144,000 now go forward and proclaim to the world that they are in the day of judgment. That's why it says in verse 6, "And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people." Verse 7 of Revelation 14, in continuation, "saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come." Earth, I know that there's this dispute. I know that you're under the aegis of the power of this world. The kings have come together and have tried to entangle you eternally in the gospel of hell. They're forcing upon you the mark of the beast. Fear not. Break away from that. Because you're in the hour of God's judgment. You can't compare this with any other day, because this is the day when the world is finally judged. Your false God is going to lose. Look at the evidence and the power that we have. Therefore, don't worry about the mark of the beast. Don't worry about the beast. Don't worry about the image of the beast. Prepare yourself to meet God. Fear him. Give glory to him. For the hour of his judgment has come. But I'm not through with the commission. You have to worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of water. You have to know who? God and the Lamb. You have to fear God and you have to worship Christ. Yet still many will worship the dragon. Some will come to the crossroads and will be tempted to lodge their tents with the devil and the dragon. Let's get a window from Psalms into those who pick the wrong side in the Super Bowl. We read our primary text, Psalms 48. Now we can visit the next chapter, Psalm 49. And then we will be able to answer that opening ponderable. Remember, we wondered why, when, how, who will succumb to Satan's sophistry? Well, Psalms 49, it allows us to hasten to the close of our study. Verse 1, hear this, all ye people. Give ear, all ye inhabitants of the world. Not talking to Israel. This is the day when the gospel goes to the world. Both low and high, rich and poor together. Chance for salvation for everybody. My mouth shall speak of wisdom, and the meditation of my heart shall be of understanding. I will incline mine ear to a parable. I will open my dark saying upon the heart. Wherefore should I fear in the days of evil? This is talking about the day when the image beast begins his activity. The day of evil. You know it's got to be the day of evil because the message of David is declared to the world. And you know it's the day of evil because Revelation chapter 13 shows that he imposes a penalty of death and intimidation upon the people of the world. Therefore, there could be no other day of evil. It's also a day of evil because those who don't fear God are going to suffer the penalty. Where should I fear in the days of evil? When the iniquity of my heels shall compass me about. Verse 6. They that trust in their wealth, that's the gig that the devil runs. He causes people to be finessed by the fact and lured by the proposition of gaining wealth. You can't trust in wealth. They that trust in their wealth and boast themselves in the multitude of their riches, none of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a ransom for him. For the redemption of their soul is precious, and it ceaseth forever. Therefore, no matter how wealthy you are, you can't buy life for yourself or for your brother. That's why you're trusting in the vanity of wealth. Verse 9 of Psalms 49. That he should still live forever and not seek corruption. We need to understand that the gospel offers life everlasting. But you see, the devil can lie. He can say, those people are going to die just like everybody else. And if you don't trust the word of God, it's going to falter. This is what the Seventh-day Adventists tell you now. That's how he's going to trick the world. And the 144,000 are going to have a powerful ministry. But the wealthy and those who have prospects of gaining wealth, it's funny how the devil can lure even poor people to think that tomorrow they're going to hit the numbers. And that's going to solve all their problems. The Lord says, even if you hit the numbers tomorrow, even if you become a millionaire tomorrow, you cannot preclude the day of your death. And since you're in the day of judgment, that day is scheduled. None of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a ransom for him. Verse 9, that he should still live forever and not see corruption. For he seeth that wise men die, likewise the fool and the brutish person perish and leave their wealth to others. Verse 11, their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever. I told you what the devil is going to deceive them with, right? You're going to continue to maintain your house forever. And their dwelling places to all generations. They call their land after their own names. Nevertheless, man, being in honor, abideth not. He is like the beast that perisheth. This their way is their folly. Yet their posterity approve their saying. Like sheep they are laid in the grave. Death shall feed on them. And the upright shall have dominion over them in the morning. And their beauty shall consume in the grave from their dwelling. But God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave. He shall receive me. All those people that are alive today that reject the truth, and all those people that have turned their backs on the truth yesterday, have no power over the grave. But David promises the day when he is going to be redeemed from the grave. That's why he said in verse 14 of chapter 48, "For this God is our God forever and ever. He will be our guide even unto death." Let us now close with the second chapter of Psalms. You can never really understand Psalms unless you combine it with the contest that's going to take place in the day of evil. Psalms chapter 2 shows the dynamics of the last battle. This is what we needed to color our understanding, whereby historically we as Adventists and Davidians have focused on the mark of the beast and the excesses of the image of the beast and 666. Verse 1 of Psalms 2. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and their rulers take counsel together against the Lord, against His anointed. I told you that it's a contemporaneous battle between the two forces. This is what they do. Their directive is to fight the house of David. But the Lord promised to fulfill those prophecies proclaimed of Him in Psalms. And in Psalms 89, says, the enemy shall not exact upon him, nor the son of wickedness afflict him. Why? Because God the Father has sealed him. You want His seal. Let us break their bands asunder, this is what the enemy says, and cast away their cords from us. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. You ever hear a good joke? This to Christ is a funny joke. Verse 4 of Psalms 2, he that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath, and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. Notice again, he says he's going to set his king. Not himself. He's going to use his anointed to defeat them. Let me break from that for a second and just read a parallel text all the way in Revelation chapter 2, verse 25. Call for patience. But that which ye have already, hold fast till I come. And he that overcometh and keepeth my works unto the end, to him will I give power over the nation. And he shall rule them with what? With a rod of iron. As the vessels of a potter shall they be broken to shivers, even as I received of my father, and I will give him the morning star. Well, this theme was borrowed directly from Psalms 2. Verse 6 in Psalms 2 says, yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. Verse 7, I will declare the decree. The Lord has said unto me, thou art my son. This day have I begotten thee. Psalms 89 again. I will also make of my firstborn higher than the kings of the earth. This day have I begotten thee, he says. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance. There's going to be an evangelization. And those that join the house of David for eternal reign are going to be given eternal ministry over themselves by the house of David. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Sound familiar? Be wise now, therefore. What does it mean to be wise? To embrace His testimony. Be wise now, therefore, O ye kings. Be instructed, ye judges of the earth. See, the preeminent people, the people that are empowered, don't want to lose their power. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Don't kiss Baal. Be dignified in the way that you embrace the kingdom. Kiss the Son. lest he be angry. I told you that the Lord has delivered the kingdom to David, and he reigns from his caprice. Therefore, you don't want to make the king angry. You want to make him happy. You want to embrace him with a holy kiss. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and ye perish from the way, when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all they that put their trust in him. We now see that the Lord, like a bookie that never loses, excuse expression, has given you the outcome of the Super Bowl. He's told you the house of David is going to reign victorious. If you can't embrace that, it's because you don't believe. And we know that God is with us from our study of Isaiah 7. And the reality of our promise is predicated upon that scripture that says, if you believe, you shall be established. Therefore, we can look forward and we can rejoice in the Lord for his greatness. Be those who believe in his holy word and in the testimony of Jesus. And having said these things, we can now bring this study to a close.